Yeah, well, thank you so much, Basma, for being here with us today to discuss your film, Ouroboros. So I'll just ask a few questions, maybe two or three, and then we'll open it up to the audience. So yeah, I wanted to start with Gaza. So of course, many of us have been thinking a lot about Gaza in the past few months, quite constantly, and I think we have yet to understand the sheer scale of the horror, and I think there's been a wide understanding or reckoning that whatever happens in Gaza actually really has consequences everywhere and has implication for the rest of the world, and that we've been feeling this very deeply, I guess, since the beginning of the genocide. And so I guess my question is also that your film is an homage to Gaza, and it very much places Gaza at the center of the world. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about the cartography of your film, that how do you think about all of these different locations working together, and what sort of map do they create?
Yeah, I mean, first, thank you for attending the screening, and thanks to the festival for putting my works in focus, especially in a time where a lot of Palestinian and pro-Palestinian voices are being silenced. It's important to recognize people who actually make it feel very easy to, or make me feel like it's not such a radical gesture to give voice to us, or shouldn't be. So I'm really honored to be here. I'm honored to share this work, which is a work I know is quite dense and not outwardly or explicitly political. And in the time that I was making it also, like, I think people have always been aware of what's happening in Palestine, but never to the degree as we are today. and basically, when I wrote the film, it was following the 2014 war in Gaza, which for me was just the tipping point in recognizing that what's happening in Gaza is happening willfully, whether or not people know the history, whether people not care or don't care about what's happening in Palestine, there's kind of a willfulness to this erasure. And like, I kept feeling that civilization had failed Gaza, that the idea of like human rights and holding people accountable or justice was really something that we might not never see. And what do you do when you are faced with this as a Palestinian? So I'm a Palestinian who grew up in diaspora, but my mother's family is from Gaza. So I grew up basically going to Gaza every year of my life. I'm able to access Palestine, but for 20 years haven't been able to go except Gaza. So without going into all the details, if you have a Gaza ID, you're then forbidden from going anywhere else in occupied Palestine. And yeah, in 2014, I thought, we're watching this massacre, we're watching these crimes happen. It's the third time I had lived through a war in Gaza. And I just felt like, rather than retelling a history or a present that has been told so explicitly for decades, I'm going to make a film that takes this situation out of its isolation and connect it to other geographies, because the only reason this is happening is because it's always happened and it will continue to happen, not just in Palestine, but this is like the history of the world. And so how, instead of saying like, oh, look at what's happening over there, it's so tragic, let's connect it to other sites and other histories and think about perseverance and resilience and also privilege. And yeah, and then proceeded to make the film in that way, in a very kind of process-based, just in a very process-based way. So it was a very much a film that was a question I was posing for myself, that then, like, I didn't know what the other locations would be or how it would be read as a political statement, but it was really, like, for me, an odd thing to say this now, because I'd never imagined we would. It's like I always knew, but also never imagined that we would be where we are today. But it, at the moment, it was also a way of paying homage to this place that had suffered so much, and even before Israel, because it's in the trade route in the Fertile Crescent. So historically, it just felt like a very personal gesture in the beginning also of to a place that I felt I was from, that I had just been watching being erased my entire life, and I just wanted to mark it. And today it feels incredibly eerie to go back to this film and feel like I had been sort of documenting what was going to come without knowing it. It's a lot more than what you asked.
No, that's great. Thank you so much. Could you maybe say a few words also about the specific locations that you've chosen and why they're meaningful?
Yeah, so like I was saying, I didn't know what the other locations were. And when I started imagining where would I want to film as I was writing the film, you know, in my mind it was like Mexico and India and Greece and just places with old civilizations and like perpetual colonization or shifts, or it was really abstract. And I realized really early on that I would need to be connected to the places I was filming through people. And so I kind of can't remember anymore like the sequence of things or who I met when, except for Diego, who's the main sort of person that we see through the film and who's a very dear friend of mine, an artist, not an actor, who I felt I could use as the kind of vehicle through the film. I mean, he was definitely the first person I was like, okay, I'm gonna work with Diego because I'm at ease being uncertain around him. And immediately just had this kind of cliche, you know, like Pasolini filmed in his home country instead of Palestine because of the occupation. And so I'm gonna film in Italy because of the occupation, but for very different reasons. And from then on, kind of found other reasons for filming in the location I did in Italy, which is Matera. And the other sites happened, yeah, very much because of the people I met and their connection to like domestic spaces or landscapes. So Brittany, the female character, if we can call her that, in the part of the film where they're in a sort of like castle, is a woman I just met happenstance in France, who whose family had inherited this castle and were charged with like keeping it up, but lived in it, but had to make it public part of the time. And I found out that it's from a 13th century estate, and that I think the first thing that struck me was like, why does this get to stay standing and everything in our part of the world is destroyed repeatedly? And how are both of these things on the same planet? I mean, it's a very like maybe poetic or esoteric way of thinking about things, but it just felt like the whole film is driven by a desire not to explain things politically or historically, but to have people enter into landscapes in a very visceral way and to force the Gazan landscape onto other sites. And so, yeah, so it became like a natural thing to just include this territory, this house or castle, and that person who also kind of felt like a person who was like a kind of Peter Pan character. And that's not in the film, but if, you know, the reasoning behind these locations are like very personal and I think read in a different way to an audience, but it's just an entry into a landscape and a character that's a vehicle into these different spaces. And so LA and the Mojave Desert are similarly like connections to people and desire for the landscape to become a character. So it's very random, actually. Like, I think, you know, idealistically, it could have been more politically significant sites. But I think even for me, as I was editing it, I recognized that it's very powerful, actually, to put like Gaza next to the Mojave Desert, next to Brittany, next to Matera, and to consider that all of these places are part of the same planet and that we are all just people, not to sound, we are the world about this, but I think that we are so used to thinking like, you know, political issues or problems are something, you know, if they're not directly connected to us, they sit on some other planet. And unfortunately, I think that's why, you know, Palestine is experiencing what it's experiencing today, is because it's always been seen as like a foreign issue for most of the world, and it is not. It is very connected to so much power and money that, I think I was just trying to have another entry point into that, which isn't the news and isn't history and isn't, yeah.
Yeah, no, I like what you're saying about how this is sort of serendipitous in a way, the way in which you've chosen those locations, but at the same time, they're still all connected to colonization in one way or the other, like the aristocratic like family, obviously, like I mean, France has its own history of colonization, and the Mojave, and Sky Hopinga, I guess, is a direct nod as well to settler colonialism in the United States as well. So it's this idea that we can't escape it, which is also very much how you sort of structure the idea of temporality and the eternal return, like how, which is the title of the film, I guess, Ouroboros, this nod to the snake that eats its own tail. So yeah, the idea of eternal return, like what does this mean for you? What does it allow you to think about? What sort of, I guess, framework does it open?
Again, it was a question. I think the title came quite late in making the film, or in writing the film. I think because I just kept thinking, you know, we're like, as a Palestinian, it's like, it's not just my generation, it's my parents and my grandparents' generation who have faced this, you know, like, now it's the end and we start over, and now it's the end and we start over. Like, there seems to be, and that, you know, you're sort of fighting a losing battle and that yet you persist. And I kept wondering, like, what is it about us? Because I think it's not just us. It's like, you know, any colonized, any oppressed people. Also growing up in the United States and seeing how, yeah, different oppressed people just keep moving forward. That is part of just like human nature. It's not specific to Palestine. It's not specific to Gaza. It's like our will to survive that's like inherently human. And I wondered if it was like part of it is forgetting, or is it repeat, is that a positive thing? Is that a negative thing? Just using this symbol and this idea of the eternal, like you are doomed to repeat your same mistakes, but you also regenerate and move forward. And how do these two things actually coexist to create the resilience that is, yeah, the will to survive, and to use that as a kind of framework for the film? Because I wasn't interested in making something narrative. I wasn't interested in, yeah, like characters or acting or story. I mean, my background is I'm a visual artist and I work in moving image, and I wanted to make, you know, I never called it a feature film when I was working on it. I just said, like, I just want to make a longer film, and sort of entered making a feature film in that way. And I felt like I needed a structure to put in all these things that normally we wouldn't think about together. And I needed the artificiality of like time and the day, and a cycle, a repeating cycle. So it's not as philosophical, and it's definitely not like Nietzsche referencing. I'm not interested in theory and philosophy, to be honest. But it was like a useful, I mean, of course I read, but I felt like I'm not actually interested in these things. I'm interested that even within the space of a film and being in a cinema, the experience of seeing these different landscapes and then having them kind of collage together at the end, what does that produce, and how do we experience time in each space, like within a cinema, not, you know, in real life, like how do we, where does it slow down, where does it pick up? Because I'm really interested in cinema, actually, as a kind of brainwashing tool, as a in its propaganda and its power to, yeah, produce an experience that we know isn't real and are nevertheless affected by it. And so I think that's how I also rely on this concept as a possibility, just to ask a question that doesn't have an answer. Like, I don't know. I don't know if it's good to forget history. I don't know. I mean, it's evident that today we, even if we remember history, it doesn't change the present. And so I think the ability to ask a question and to discuss is actually, to discuss the possibilities is a more than ever important. And maybe I'm just saying that because I live in Germany, where that is not allowed anymore, or maybe never has been, but yeah.
Well, thanks so much. I'm just going to ask a very quick third question and then we'll open it up. You were talking about all of these different spaces and how they work together. It's clear that the section on Gaza sort of stands out as a bit different. Part of the reason is also because it hasn't been shot by you, actually, and it was using a different device, the drone, and it was shot by Yasser Murtaja. So I don't know if you want to say a few words about your collaboration with Yasser and who he is.
Yeah. So when I wrote the film, Gaza was the first location, and I knew that, like, I could go to Gaza and I could have filmed it myself, but I didn't want to. I wanted actually to reproduce this very cold, kind of clinical look at Gaza. Like, normally it's looked at like that by the military. I mean, not the sort of drone shots inside the house, but or the Steadicam inside the house, but a lot of the drone and the kind of topographical filming is how Israel looks at the Gaza Strip. And I wanted to reproduce that in a different way, to like shift it into a different space and make it more intimate. But I knew that that part needed to be on video, and that the rest of the film would be on film and have this really like lush kind of meditative, or yeah, like more poetic sort of nostalgic feel to it. And that all of the other, yeah, the entire film that wasn't Palestine, that wasn't Gaza, would have, I just lost my train of thought, which has been happening a lot these days. Let's just leave it there. So when I was planning the shoots for Gaza, which came last, I worked with a Palestinian producer who had just gotten in contact with a young journalist, essentially, who was setting up a media company, had like bought all these drones. He was about 30 years old, and really ambitious, was a strong cinematographer. And so we hired him to do all the drone shots and all of the inside of the house shots. And I directed everything remotely. And again, I could have gone in person, but there was something about like, yeah, the distance needed to be there, and it needed to be unemotional and sort of like, I don't know, documenting something, like preserving something in this way. And so we did this at the very end of the film, of the production of shooting. And yeah, he was incredible to work with, and it was interesting to just like, from my memory, have to list like streets or how I wanted the house filmed. I don't know what to describe it or what the words are, but it was interesting to do this like remote directing shoot, which I had never done. After the film was finished and we premiered it, this Yasser, who was the cinematographer, he was documenting in 2018 the Great March of Return, these border protests that were happening in Gaza, with people trying to storm the north border and leave Gaza, essentially. And he was wearing a press jacket. He was just photographing, and he was killed by an IDF soldier. And even for me, as a Palestinian who has grown up seeing death repeatedly and knowing exactly what Israel and the IDF does, was shocked, thinking, even though this is like a very common thing, I mean, the killing of journalists that we're seeing in extreme numbers today has always been happening. And they're not just young, unknown people. They are sometimes incredibly prominent, very known journalists. And even for me, who is very familiar with this tactic, was in complete shock that this had happened, and felt like the things that I'm talking about in my film are actually just continuing over and over, and seemingly with full impunity. I mean, someone wearing a press jacket, photographing, standing on the sides, is shot point blank. And so I'm very grateful to have worked with him, and I'm grateful, yeah, to be able to have platforms to speak about him and the future that he would have had that is lost.
Thank you so much. So I think there's a mic going around. So if somebody from the audience wants to ask a question, you're very welcome. Oh, can we?
Thank you so much for sharing the film, Basma. I'm seeing it for the second time, and it still feels like there's so much to understand, grapple with, think with, feel with, particularly seeing it these days. I wanted to ask, because you spoke very eloquently, I think, both about what it is to, you know, move across locations and shift Gaza into different spaces in the world, as well as temporality. To ask you just about the final scene, because I think it's so striking, and to ask you about it in the context of rhythm and sound more broadly in the film, as well as maybe just a feeling of diaspora. I mean, speaking also as a Palestinian who grew up in the United States, there's a way in which seeing all of that imagery and kind of flashes together gives me a very powerful sense of what it is to feel here and there at the same time, and to feel also that, you know, some of those images, the images of Gaza being destroyed in 2014, alongside images of kind of visual splendor or opulence or open space, that disjuncture is just so powerfully felt in that moment, particularly when you have this kind of rhythm of almost a, you know, a music video coming after what is often quite a slow film. So if you could just speak about that some.
Yeah, thank you for your question, and thank you for watching it twice also. I think, yeah, I mean, I always thought that the end of the film, I didn't know quite how I would do it. I didn't know it would be this like quick edit sort of strategy, but I knew I wanted to bring all four sites together. I think initially I thought about it as overlay, just like keeping in the pace of the film, not having that kind of like intense techno at the end. And this is maybe like a private thing, it's not so like significant, but I had this dream that, I actually really hate when filmmakers do this, but I'm gonna do it. I had a dream that I was in a taxi in Gaza, and like basically what you see play out at the end of the film, something about like my father was dead and I didn't know, or it's not quite exactly what is in the film, but just something about receiving terrible news without someone speaking it to me, and then suddenly floating above the ground, and that these children were writing out in chalk the beginning, like a signal to someone in the sky, and that I couldn't tell if it was hell or hello, and that I woke up in that moment and was dying to know if they were just saying hello or if they were communicating from hell. And it was in the middle of working on the film and already in dialogue with Sky Hopinka, who does the voiceover in the Gaza sections, who's Native American, who's speaking in a dialect that almost went extinct, that he himself relearned or like had to learn, who's an artist in his own right, a brilliant artist, brilliant filmmaker. And we'd been talking about how to translate into this dialect. And that he would do the voiceover when I think I had this dream in the middle of it and then rewrote the end of the film. And I felt like I can't just, like the film is meditative in this way. It's like a kind of landscape film. It's meant to sort of lull you into like your own thoughts, actually. You're not supposed to be presently engaged in everything. I mean, when I first was doing Q&As about this film, I used to say like there is so much fucking information on our conflict that I don't need to explain one more word. And I feel that more than ever today, with anger and bitterness, actually, that I'm not gonna talk about this anymore because I'm so angry about the amount of information. And when I was making this film, I felt like, actually, if it pisses people off that they can't get it, good. Because if you don't get it now, you're never gonna get it. And if you're curious to try and put it together from your position, from what you know, then great. Like, that's what cinema should do on some level. Not always. It can entertain more. It can be more straightforward. But that wasn't my interest. And sorry, I'm just, yeah, speaking about whatever I want to speak about at this point. And so I was conscious that I was kind of going to put my audience through something difficult or, like, you know, a bit more challenging, or that they would need to do more work. And I think at the end, I didn't want it to just stay in this meditative space, but actually just to like wake it up and really force these spaces together in a more activated way, in a more like suddenly your body wakes up at the end of the film. You know, you can fall asleep. I fall asleep in films all the time, and I think it's actually quite pleasurable. And this morning in Teddy Williams' film, my eyes closed and I kept hearing the film, and I started hallucinating a different scene. And when I opened it, I was really surprised that it was really different than what I was experiencing. But it created a really interesting experience, that it was bringing something from my subconscious into his work that might not be too far from what he's trying to say. And so I think I was aware people can fall asleep, and in this moment they wake up, and all of these spaces will suddenly collapse into each other, and Gaza won't be isolated, and this will be the kind of homage that it could be they're saying hello, it could be that they're speaking from hell, and at the end, you're part of it, you're awake again. And so it's just a very visceral kind of gesture at the end of the film, I guess.
Someone else? Can't see much.
Hi, thanks for this film. Lots of food for thought. I am very curious about this device of playing the footage backwards that seems to be a recurrence in your work. Like I saw this morning in Deep Silence. So what motivates you to use this device repeatedly, and where do you want to get with that?
It's actually just a strategy I use when I'm editing to try and understand and get distance from what I'm looking at. Is often I play the footage backwards, like in a lot of the works that are more experimental and non-narrative that I've made, and especially when it's maybe not only, but when I've shot in Palestine, I think I think, you know, when you look at a footage going forward in motion, it looks like reality, or it just falls flat, and you forget that you're looking at an image. You think that you're looking at the place. And so I often watch my rushes backwards to understand the flow of the image and the frame and the composition, like the very formal aspects of it. And often it's just a way of slowing down and being aware that what you're looking at isn't reality, it's like someone's interpretation of that reality, and that there's a message being sent, even if we're just looking at a scene and there's no dialogue and there's no, there's nothing more to it. I think in Ouroboros especially, it was to play with temporality, like to not really know where you are in time, to really get lost in the image, to feel that as the film is moving forwards, things are going backwards, like, which is also maybe very much what it feels like with this colonization, is that the more that we get closer to seeing liberation, the further away we feel from it, and it's a really violent and horrifying thing to live with your entire life and for generations, like this dangling of a carrot of we might see liberation, and then all, you know. I think I wanted that feeling of like you're being sucked back in time even as you're moving forward in time. Yeah.
Well, talking about, I guess, the different rhythms, I guess, it's also striking, obviously, this is the first feature that you're making as well. So how did you approach it differently maybe from your shorter... something struck me from what you said. It struck me from what you said earlier. About the amount of information that there is obviously on Palestine, but also it's a technique also that you've been using in your earlier works to sort of like capturing various senses at the same time, and sort of like, and this film is very different, so I don't know if that makes sense. It's like a different ideas at the same time, but I guess it's a different rhythm, a different, I guess, engagement with information or with creating meaning, I guess. I don't know.
I mean, I didn't approach it differently, and maybe that's one of the problems of the film. And I don't feel, I mean, I was saying this earlier when we spoke, that I've, like, people will sometimes advise me on how to speak about my film, not in political terms, but like, because I'm very open about the things that I see that are a problem. And actually, I think that's really incorrect. Like, I think people should be open about the mistakes or the failures that they see in their work, because it just means it's like motivation to do a next work or to, Yeah, it's just like I don't understand why we have to act like the thing that we've seen is like a finished product and not a masterpiece, but something closed, and that this is the only way it could be. There's so many things I see in the film that I would change, like I wouldn't change, but I know don't work, for example. And I think but not approaching it as a feature film is not one of those things, because I think my language is much more, the way I've been how I formed my practice or how I make my work is coming from a visual arts background with a deep interest in like cinema and the tropes, cinema tropes, and how cinema functions. And I think those two things together are a very powerful, at least for me politically, were also like a very powerful entry point into making cinema. Like I really felt at the time that I started, there weren't so many Palestinian voices and being educated in America, it felt like, oh, I can sneak into the experimental film scene and then scare them with my anti-Zionist position, also as a woman. And so when I came to make the film again, I was actually initially thought of it as an installation that would be on four screens, four different landscapes, each one 20 minutes. And then I started thinking, actually, no, you need to experience each one in its own time, and then they blend together. And the way I made it is essentially the way I make all my short films, and very process-based, very non-narrative. And the scariest part of doing that was actually that, yeah, actually suddenly the length of time of the film was a thing I felt like a complete fraud stepping into, because I realized you don't really know what you're doing. The editing of 15 or 30 minute short film is a completely different monster than a 60 plus film. And the idea of sustaining an audience, and especially when you don't have like characters or a plot, is a space that I was stepping into that I was completely clueless about, and was a learning experience. And so the idea that this was my first feature isn't appropriate, actually, because I don't know if I would make a second feature, but I might make another long film. But it's not following that industry model. And I was like a complete idiot in these spaces where I would meet, you know, producers or people who would like, you know, potentially support the project. I would just start talking to them about ideas the way artists do, and people would look at me and be like, I'm sorry, what are you saying? Like, we're not interested in your ideas. We're interested in a final product. And so, yeah, I don't think. I don't know if that's the
no, no, answer, that's helpful. You're right. Like, the idea of feature is probably not the appropriate term to think about it.
Following up on my first question about playing footage backwards, that opening segment where that lady goes through the house, well, she was going out, but she comes back in and demonstrates each of the rooms in the house and tidies up whatever is out of place, gives us the impression that she is, whether you want it to be reality or not, we spectators understand it as an existing person in an existing house. So there is a supposed reality behind what's going on. And I, for one, became very curious about that character and why she was there. And in that luxurious place, whether it's a hotel or a mansion or whatever it is, it's something totally unusual. It seems to be being prepared for closing up and being preserved, because all the sofas and beds and everything is covered up with throws and spreads, and everything is super tidy, and there are the pictures of people who are not there. So is she the last one who was left in that kind of palace? What is going on? Is she a cleaner, a maid in the house? And she's the only black person we see there. So there are many indications in that scene, but hardly any explanation. So I became very curious about what point is being made there. Thanks.
Yeah. So I think it's nice hearing you speak through all of the possibilities, because you basically kind of hit on everything. You get very close to what it is. Like, and so much of the film is my very, very personal, private intention and a very strict, formal, like, organization of those things. And my hope is always that, like, an audience knowing nothing about me or the film or the history of this place will get close enough, but from their personal and particular perspective, because that's what we do in all cinema. And most of the time, cinema is trying to, like commercial cinema, is trying to just like lowest common denominator, make it as clear as possible for everyone. And I think experimental cinema does the opposite and says, you come and you decipher with what you know, and let's hope it's intriguing enough that if you don't know, you are hungry to look further into what this was or what this might have been and that you saw or that you imagine. And so, like, I could explain everything about what that house is and who this character is. And there's a lot, you know, there's a lot in that scene. And I'm trying to decide how much to talk about it. And we had this conversation before the Q&A because this film was finished and premiered in 2017. And I've done a lot of Q&As for it. And since October, when I've been asked to do Q&As, I have, by complete surprise to myself, started weeping, basically, in the middle of a Q&A, because that is my family home, and that's a person I know. And there are a lot of, you know, like, things that are quite raw for me at the moment in relation to Gaza. I mean, my history, my present, and my future have been obliterated, and family have been massacred, and I'm having to perform every day that things are normal when they are far beyond normal. And not just for me, I think the entire world, not because Palestine is more important, but because there are very important pillars in civilization that have just crumbled in front of us. Yeah, so I still don't really know. I mean, it's difficult to... Yeah, it's difficult to speak about. I think I was also thinking that since saying, like, I don't really want to talk about the house and that person, and because I don't want to cry and make everybody uncomfortable and fatigue myself, but I mean, fuck it. Like, I'm uncomfortable, you can be uncomfortable. But I feel like I can explain that's my family's house that my mother was born in. It's my grandparents' home. Everyone was living there until 2014. There was never the idea that we would leave, that the whole family would leave. I grew up in that house. I went there every summer. The woman that we see in the film is a domestic worker who actually appealed to my grandfather, who organized. He was the head of the Red Crescent Society in Gaza. He's a medical doctor, but he was also a political figure in Gaza, nonpartisan. And this woman, when she was like in her 20s or 30s, so a long time ago, went to my grandfather because her husband had been imprisoned unrightly by Israel and lost her source of income, had like 8 kids. And so in order to help her, he hired her as a domestic worker and tried to work on his case to get her husband out of prison. He never came out, or he didn't come out for like 30 years. And so she was part of the family. She's Afro-Palestinian. She's from Deir al-Balah. I grew up with her daughters. There are very much class differences and all of the things that are wrong about domestic laborers and race in Palestine. We're not immune from racism, even within our own societies. But she's someone who I was very close to. She is alive. Her daughters are alive. Her kids are alive. But the reason in that film, the reason why I wanted her to be the one going through the house is because she is the reason I survived a war, because the whole family had left after, so they were in the 2009 war, they left and the house was empty, and my grandmother asked her if we could continue to pay her as a domestic worker, that she could go to the house and make it look inhabited while the whole family was out. And this is a three-story house where like my uncles and their families lived on the top and bottom floor, and my grandparents were on the main. And so she made the house appear inhabited. And when we went back for a visit in 2012, there was a war, which is the smallest of these of the three wars prior to the genocide happened. We had just arrived a week before, and in that war, Israel was bombing empty homes. And so there was this feeling that, okay, do they know that we've come back? Because we've just been here 7 days. And the reason that we believe they didn't bomb the house was because Nama, the woman in the film, had been going. And so she saved my life. She saved our lives. And I wanted her as the kind of, I wanted her to be this ghost that also isn't that has a different like status actually within even Palestinians. I mean, there isn't systemic racism because we're under occupation, but there's still racism within Palestinian culture. And I really wanted her to be this, the kind of, I don't know, the presence within our home. Like she belongs to that house more than I do actually. And so I was trying to film her in a way that would honor her and make clear also that, yeah, this isn't her home. It's clearly there. The pictures on the wall don't, we're different races, but that somehow we help each other, that there's this, you know, none of that stuff communicates. It's why sometimes I also don't talk about it, because it's, I think the aura of what I'm describing is hopefully felt in the film, but yeah, today I decided to explain it.
I think we're out of time. So thank you so much for your questions, and thank you for being here, and see you hopefully. There's an In Focus conversation tomorrow at, I forget the time, Peter, do you remember? I think it's 3:15, 3:15.
In the afternoon.
Yeah.
Check the schedule.
Yeah, basically, check the schedule. Thank you so much, and let's thank Basma again.
Thank you.